Layer 524, Roosevelt and African Americans. If I came out for the anti-lynching bill now, they, Southern Democrats, will block every bill I ask Congress to pass to keep America from collapsing. I just can't take that risk. Franklin Roosevelt to leaders of the NAACP, 1936. FDR's New Deal provided vital economic assistance to African Americans, but it rarely challenged widespread racial segregation and discrimination in 1930s America. The administration wasn't hostile to black Americans, but FDR needed the support of powerful Southern Democrats in Congress to enact his economic agenda. To keep their support, he distanced himself from efforts to ban the poll tax and make lynching a federal crime. With Eleanor Roosevelt's strong encouragement, FDR appointed blacks to significant second-tier positions in his administration, creating the so-called Black Cabinet. And some prominent New Dealers, urged on by ER, worked to ensure relief programs didn't exclude blacks. But they often accommodated, or were unable to overcome, existing patterns of discrimination. The CCC established separate black camps. The WPA relegated blacks and Hispanics to low-paying jobs. The FHA refused mortgages to blacks moving into white neighborhoods. And federally financed public housing was racially segregated. Directly underneath this panel is another Confront the Issue interactive flipbook entitled Roosevelt and Race. During the 1930s, African Americans ended their long allegiance to the Republican Party, which dated back to the days of Abraham Lincoln, and became a reliable Democratic voting bloc. Yet despite this overwhelming support, FDR did not become a champion of civil rights. Roosevelt recognized the grievances of African Americans, but believed his New Deal reforms would be jeopardized if he took advanced positions on race. There was little active support for civil rights reform among Northern whites, and white Southerners were deeply opposed. FDR's ability to get legislation through Congress depended upon the support of long-serving Southern Democrats who chaired many key committees. Later, as World War II approached, he would need the same Southern committee chairman to overcome isolationists in Congress who opposed increased defense spending and aid to Britain. Increasingly, FDR found himself caught between two important Democratic constituencies with conflicting agendas. His dilemma came into bold relief in 1940 when African American labor leader A. Philip Randolph threatened to lead a massive march on Washington to protest racial discrimination in defense industries. Eleanor Roosevelt supported Randolph and helped arrange an Oval Office meeting with FDR. At that meeting, FDR tried to persuade Randolph to abandon his threat. But when he stood firm, the president agreed to issue an executive order creating the Fair Employment Practices Commission, the FEPC. The FEPC was empowered to investigate and overturn race discrimination in industries engaged in military production. Roosevelt never agreed to African-American leaders' demand that he end racial discrimination in America's armed forces. But World War II provided FDR with opportunities to take action against discrimination without having to go to Congress and to create an environment in which minorities could advance in the military. In 1940, Benjamin O. Davis, Sr. became the Army's first black brigadier general. During the war, blacks were admitted to the Marine Corps for the first time, and the Army Air Corps ended its ban on black pilots. With strong public support from First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, nearly 1,000 black pilots were trained at Alabama's Tuskegee Institute. Many of the Tuskegee Airmen served in North Africa and Europe in the all-black 99th Pursuit Squadron. The following material includes reproductions of selected documents from the FDR Library and excerpts of the historical debate that relate to FDR and African Americans. You may continue listening to these quotes or press the right arrow key on your audio tour player to exit this layer of information and continue with the rest of the tour. Section 1. African Americans and the New Deal. Caption: Eleanor Roosevelt visits a Work Progress Administration nursery school for African American children in Des Moines, Iowa, June 8, 1936. The following documents relate to the New Deal and the African American experience in general. Document 1.1, Harry Hopkins' letter about FDR's statement on the WPA. June 17, 1935. Though the New Deal provided assistance to African Americans, this aid was often administered in a discriminatory manner. FDR felt constrained by the anti-civil rights attitudes of powerful Southern congressional leaders whose support he needed for his legislative program. Consequently, domestic and agricultural workers, fields in which blacks were disproportionately represented, were often excluded from New Deal reforms such as Social Security and minimum wage laws. Some agricultural reforms unintentionally worsened the plight of Southern sharecroppers and tenant farmers. Blacks were employed in the Civilian Conservation Corps and other work programs, but they were often segregated in low-skill, low-paying jobs. Some New Deal administrators were sympathetic to civil rights issues, including Harry Hopkins of the Works Progress Administration, Aubrey Williams of the National Youth Administration, and Harold Ickes of the Public Works Administration. They worked to eradicate discrimination in their programs. In this 1935 letter to White House Press Secretary Stephen Early, Hopkins suggests some anti-discrimination talking points for President Roosevelt to make in a presentation to WPA administrators. Document 1.2A/2B. Eleanor Roosevelt's memo to FDR and letter to Mary McLeod Bethune, November 22nd through the 27th, 1941. Despite its shortcomings, the New Deal provided opportunities for African Americans to serve in government in small but unprecedented numbers. Sympathetic New Deal officials appointed African Americans as special advisors to help focus aid efforts on the black community. This so-called black cabinet met periodically to steer the administration towards more inclusive policies. Mary McLeod Bethune of the National Youth Administration was a leader of this group and a close friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. At Bethune's urging, Mrs. Roosevelt sent this memo to FDR asking him to appoint an African American to a high position in government to advise on issues important to blacks. FDR's handwritten response reads, "No, any more than I can put in a Jew as such or a spiritualist as such. FDR." At the bottom is Mrs. Roosevelt's instruction to her secretary on drafting a reply to Bethune. Section 2. FDR and Anti-Lynching Legislation. Caption: One of the great stains on FDR's civil rights record is his failure to actively support federal anti-lynching legislation. As horrific cases of lynching spiked throughout the South and other parts of the country, private organizations worked to prevent them, while Eleanor Roosevelt and civil rights leaders urged FDR to take action. The following documents relate to the subject of FDR and anti-lynching legislation. Document 2.1, Letter to FDR from Walter White of the NAACP, May 1, 1934. As the Great Depression deepened, the number of lynchings of African American men increased. Most lynchings took place in the South, although incidents did occur in other parts of the country. Such murders were left to state and local officials to prosecute, but toxic notions of white supremacy and Jim Crow discrimination laws resulted in the failure to bring perpetrators to justice. This crisis led to calls for a federal anti-lynching law, known as the Costigan-Wagner Bill, allowing federal law enforcement to step in when state and local officials failed. Walter White, head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, was one of the bill's strongest advocates. but the legislation needed FDR support to get a vote in Congress. After consulting with Eleanor Roosevelt, White wrote this impassioned letter to the president. FDR did not respond. Document 2.2, text of proposed NAACP press release, May 11, 1934. As the 1934 congressional session neared its end, NAACP leader Walter White desperately sought a meeting with FDR to gain his support for anti-lynching legislation. Eleanor Roosevelt arranged a White House tea with her and FDR on May 7, 1934. The president told ER and White that while he privately supported the bill, he would do nothing to stop an expected Senate filibuster. He could not challenge his party's Southern leadership in Congress on this issue, he said, without risking his entire New Deal program. Refusing to be discouraged, White focused on FDR's personal support for the bill. He sent this draft press release to White House Press Secretary Stephen Early for approval. Instead, Early had the draft filed without reply. No further action was taken on the bill before the 1934 session ended. Document 2.3, Memorial Petition to FDR to Support Anti-Lynching Legislation, December 1934. As the 1935 congressional session approached, Eleanor Roosevelt and Walter White of the NAACP renewed their pressure on President Roosevelt to back the Costigan-Wagner anti-lynching legislation. To demonstrate that the bill had broad public support, White circulated this petition, or memorial, among sympathetic governors, mayors, college presidents, newspaper editors, pastors, judges, and private organizations. White hoped to present the petition in person to the president in late December 1934, before the opening session of the new Congress. The meeting never took place, and the petition was buried in the White House files. Document 2.4, Memorandum for Stephen Early, April 25, 1935. On January 4, 1935, FDR introduced an ambitious legislative agenda for the year. The NAACP's Walter White was bitterly disappointed that it did not include an anti-lynching bill. Still, White continued his efforts to pass the bill when it was reintroduced in the new Congress. Throughout the spring, he and Eleanor Roosevelt unsuccessfully urged the president to prevent another Senate filibuster. When the filibuster began in late April, White appealed to the White House for a presidential meeting. However, FDR's staff, sensitive to the damage Southern Democrats could do to the president's agenda, blocked White's access. As this memo reveals, White's request first went to Press Secretary Stephen Early. Presidential Political Secretary Marvin McIntyre, known as Mac, also weighed in, recommending that FDR not meet with White. The president responded, "Mac is right. FDR." Anti-lynching legislation did not pass in 1935. But the Social Security Act, National Labor Relations Act, and other hallmark New Deal reforms did. Document 2.5, Letter from Mary McLeod Bethune to FDR, January 18, 1940. Anti-lynching legislation was repeatedly introduced in Congress, only to fail because of a Senate filibuster by Southern Democrats. In a dramatic moment in 1937, Eleanor Roosevelt sat in the Senate galleries throughout a seven-day filibuster before the bill once again went down to defeat. By 1938, the NAACP and Walter White concluded that a federal anti-lynching law simply would not pass and gave less priority to it. However, other groups continue to push for the law, as seen in this 1940 letter from Eleanor Roosevelt's close friend and civil rights leader, Mary McLeod Bethune. Anti-lynching legislation never became law during Roosevelt's presidency. Section 3, FDR and the Poll Tax. Caption: African Americans were almost universally disenfranchised in Southern states. As late as 1940, less than 5% of eligible black voters were registered. A common tool used to keep African Americans from voting was the poll tax, which placed an economic burden on poor blacks. If they could not pay the tax, they could not vote. The following documents relate to FDR and the poll tax issue. Document 3.1, Petition to the President of the United States, 1942. Throughout the 1930s, FDR was frustrated by the conservative southern wing of his party. Roosevelt believed that the poll tax was a major cause of the continued dominance of conservatives in the South. It disenfranchised African Americans who were supportive of the New Deal. In a March 1938 speech in Gainesville, Georgia, FDR condemned the South's feudal system, likening it to fascist movements in Europe. If you believe in the one, you lean to the other. As America's entry into World War II began to break down existing social barriers, a campaign to abolish the poll tax gained strength, as reflected in this petition sent to the White House in 1942. Document 3.2, Memo from Malvina C. Thompson to Jonathan Daniels, March 11, 1945. In November 1942, FDR sent a memo to Attorney General Francis Biddle suggesting that poll taxes were unconstitutional because poor people who could not pay the tax were denied access to the voting booth. If Congress would not abolish the poll tax nationwide, he wrote, then each state's poll tax restrictions should be challenged in court. The president suggested that the question of race need not be raised in any way, on the ground that in poll tax states, a very large number of whites, as well as Negroes, are in effect denied the right to vote. The Attorney General did not pursue FDR's suggested court actions. However, both FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt supported ongoing efforts to repeal the poll tax at the state level. In this 1945 memo to White House Secretary Jonathan Daniels, Eleanor's personal secretary, Malvina C. Thompson, informs the president of a new anti-poll tax campaign in Alabama. Section 4, The March on Washington and Executive Order 8802. Caption: As war mobilization began to lift the nation out of the Depression, discrimination by industry and labor excluded many African Americans from the full benefits of the economic boom. Civil rights leaders threatened a march on Washington. In response, on June 25, 1941, FDR issued Executive Order 8802, barring racial discrimination in defense industries. The following documents relate to FDR, the March on Washington, and Executive Order 8802. Document 4.1, FDR's exchange of memos with William Knudsen, May 26 to 28, 1941. One of the most influential civil rights leaders of the 1930s and 1940s was A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, an all-black union of railroad workers. Outraged by stories of new defense plants refusing to hire qualified African Americans over less qualified whites, Randolph was determined to take action. In early 1941, Randolph announced his intention to organize a march on Washington. When FDR learned from Eleanor Roosevelt of well-educated blacks only finding work as janitors and cleaners in defense plants, he sent this memo to William Knudsen and Sidney Hillman at the Office of Production Management, the agency overseeing the defense industry. Knudsen replied that OPM would quietly try to get plant managers to increase the number of African-American workers. Document 4.2, FDR's memo for Marvin McIntyre, June 7, 1941. The administration's promise to quietly increase the number of African-Americans in defense plants failed to satisfy A. Philip Randolph, Eleanor Roosevelt, and others. FDR felt more and more pressure as the July 1st date for the March on Washington neared. Dr. F. O. Williston, a prominent black leader in Washington, D.C., contacted the White House and asked for a meeting to discuss African-American issues in the military and in defense work. In this memo to Presidential Political Secretary Marvin McIntyre, known as Mac, FDR expresses his increasing frustration at the situation and recommends telling Williston that the best contribution he could make to relieving tensions over race issues is to stop that march. Document 4.3, Memorandum for the President, June 14, 1941. As pressure mounted on the White House and the March on Washington neared, FDR asked Audrey Williams, the liberal head of the National Youth Administration, to organize a meeting in New York City with Eleanor Roosevelt, New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, Anna Rosenberg of the Social Security Board, and black leaders A. Philip Randolph and the NAACP's Walter White. Williams's job was to get the March on Washington stopped. From FDR's point of view, the results were unsatisfactory, as can be seen in this memo to the president from Secretary Edwin M. Watson. Watson relays Mayor LaGuardia's opinion that the only thing that could stop the march would be a high-level meeting at the White House attended by the president and other officials. FDR agreed, and a meeting was scheduled for June 18, 1941. Document 4.4, Proposals of the Negro March on Washington Committee to President Roosevelt, circa June 18, 1941. At the June 18, 1941 meeting at the White House, FDR first tried to distract his visitors with anecdotes and stories. A. Philip Randolph, the leader of the March on Washington effort, would have none of it, stating simply, "Mr. President, time is running out." He asked the president to issue an executive order banning discrimination in the defense industry. FDR countered that he couldn't do anything until the March on Washington was canceled. Randolph replied that it could not be called off and that he expected 100,000 marchers to arrive in Washington in less than 2 weeks. With talks at an impasse, New York Mayor LaGuardia suggested that they begin working on a formula that would resolve the issue. The black leaders and government officials adjourned to the cabinet room to work on a proposed solution. Among the sticking points, as can be seen in this document, was the civil rights leaders' demand that any executive order not just ban discrimination in the defense industry, but also in the military and the federal government. The president told LaGuardia that this was a deal breaker. Document 4.5, Executive Order 8802, June 25, 1941. 1 week after the White House meeting, a compromise was reached. FDR would issue an executive order banning racial discrimination in the hiring of workers in all industries engaged in defense production. The order also would contain general, but not legally binding language, opposing discrimination in the federal government. This carefully crafted wording satisfied most sides, including Eleanor Roosevelt, who encouraged A. Philip Randolph to accept the deal. FDR signed Executive Order 8802 on June 25, 1941. In return, Randolph canceled the March on Washington. Although EO 8802 was issued grudgingly by FDR, it is viewed today as an important step in the early civil rights movement and helped bring the economic benefits of the war boom to the nation's African-American citizens. Document 4.6, A. Philip Randolph's letter to FDR, June 30, 1941. An important part of banning discrimination in defense industries was the manner in which such a ban would be enforced. Executive Order 8802 included a provision establishing a Fair Employment Practices Committee, FEPC, authorized to investigate and remedy any discriminatory practices. In this letter to FDR, sent after EO 8802 was signed, March on Washington leader A. Philip Randolph was grateful that the FEPC had been established, but concerned about the committee's membership. Randolph asked that he and NAACP Executive Secretary Walter White be allowed input on appointees to the FEPC. The five-member committee appointed by FDR on July 18, 1941, included two African Americans. Document 4.7, Presidential Memorandum to Government Department Heads, September 3, 1941. As the work of the FEPC began to reduce discrimination in defense industries, it made discrimination in some parts of the government all the more glaring. Although FDR was resistant to issuing an executive order banning discrimination outright throughout the federal government, on September 3, 1941, he issued this memorandum to all the heads of government departments and agencies. It urges them to review their work practices to ensure that, in the federal service, the doors of employment are open to all loyal and qualified workers, regardless of creed, race, or national origin. Section 5. The Detroit Race Riots of 1943. Caption: The war boom and Executive Order 8802 drew African-American workers to northern cities and southern workplaces in unprecedented numbers. Racial tensions increased as blacks and whites competed for jobs and housing. In the spring and summer of 1943, race riots broke out across the country, the worst in Detroit in June 1943. The following documents relate to FDR and the 1943 Detroit race riots. Document 5.1, FDR's Memorandum to Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, June 21, 1943. The race riot in Detroit began on Sunday, June 20, 1943, in a public park known as Belle Isle that was frequented mostly by African Americans. On that hot summer day, the park was filled to capacity with nearly 100,000 people. Fights began to break out between whites and blacks on the approaches to the park. Rumors began to circulate of black women and children being killed. Roving gangs of both blacks and whites roamed the streets. Michigan Governor Harry Kelly insisted that local police could handle the crisis, but by the next day, it was obvious that the situation was out of control. He asked President Roosevelt for federal assistance to end the riots. In response, FDR issued an anti-insurrection proclamation and then sent this memorandum to Secretary of War Henry Stimson, directing that federal troops be used to bring order to Detroit. 3,800 troops arrived at 11 a.m., and by late afternoon, peace had been restored. By the time the violence ended, nearly 1,000 people had been injured, and 25 African Americans and 9 whites were dead. Document 5.2, letter to FDR from New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, June 27, 1943. After federal troops had calmed the situation in Detroit, the press and public officials began to explore the causes of the riots. In this letter to FDR, New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia urged the president to leave troops in place in Detroit so that the discontent would not spread to other population centers. In reality, many issues came together to cause the outbreak of violence. In particular, Detroit's population had grown exponentially as a result of the defense industry. In just 2 years, the city had added 250,000 people, including 150,000 African Americans, to its population of over 2 million. Because of this growth, blacks and whites competed over inadequate housing, transportation, and recreation sites. Eleanor Roosevelt was particularly disturbed by the Detroit riots and by increased racial violence everywhere, telling a friend, "Detroit should never have happened." However, FDR's fear of alienating Southern Democrats in Congress prevented him from speaking out or taking corrective action, and racial tensions continued to simmer throughout the war. Section 6. African Americans in the Military. Caption: Before and during World War II, FDR was pressured to allow African Americans to serve in the military on an equal basis with whites. Facing strong opposition from military leaders and Congress, FDR refused to desegregate the armed forces. But the war did provide him, and Eleanor Roosevelt, with opportunities to take action against discrimination. Document 6.1, Eleanor Roosevelt's Memorandum to FDR. September 1940. In September 1940, A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Walter White of the NAACP, and Arnold Hill of the Urban League asked Eleanor Roosevelt to help arrange a meeting with the president. They wanted to press FDR to eliminate discrimination in the armed forces. In this memo, Eleanor urges FDR to meet with the black leaders immediately. A meeting was arranged in the Oval Office for September 27, 1940, with Navy Secretary Frank Knox and Assistant Secretary of War Robert Patterson in attendance. The black leaders left with the impression that FDR agreed with them, at least on some points. They were disappointed when, days later, the government announced it would continue its discriminatory practices in the military with only minor changes. Document 6.2, Letter to Eleanor Roosevelt from F.D. Patterson, President of Tuskegee Institute, July 26, 1941. Eleanor Roosevelt was a longtime supporter and patron of the Tuskegee Institute, a black college in Tuskegee, Alabama, founded by Booker T. Washington. After FDR's meeting with African American leaders at the White House in September 1940, the Army established an aviation training program for blacks at Tuskegee. Mrs. Roosevelt was keenly interested in this program, as can be seen in this letter to ER from Tuskegee Institute's president, F.D. Patterson. Earlier that year, Mrs. Roosevelt had traveled to Tuskegee and taken a ride in a Piper Cub airplane with Charles A. Anderson. The photographs of her flight with a black pilot caused a sensation in both white and African-American press outlets. The 99th Pursuit Squadron, known as the Tuskegee Airmen, served with great distinction in North Africa, Italy, and Germany. Document 6.3, Eleanor Roosevelt's exchange of letters with Cecil Peterson, May 28 through July 7, 1942. Eleanor Roosevelt continued her support of the Tuskegee Airmen after the United States entered the war. In 1942, she began corresponding with a young African-American trainee at the Tuskegee Institute, Cecil Peterson. Mrs. Roosevelt had met Peterson years before while visiting a New Deal project in Quoddy, Maine. They continued their exchange of letters throughout the war, and Mrs. Roosevelt was even able to meet Peterson on one of her trips to visit troops overseas. Document 6.4, Eleanor Roosevelt's letter to Evans C. Johnson, September 18, 1942. The war changed the traditional social structure in the United States. As African Americans began to press for equal treatment in defense work, military service, housing, and other areas, many whites grew increasingly uncomfortable. They searched for someone to blame for causing this massive change, and Eleanor Roosevelt, whose sympathy for black civil rights was well publicized, became a target of their anger. In this reply to an outraged citizen, Mrs. Roosevelt explains her support for African Americans in the context of the war being fought overseas. Paralleling FDR's Four Freedoms, ER states her own four fundamental rights for African Americans at home: the right to an education, to earn a living, and to equal justice before the law, and the right to vote. Document 6.5, Memos to the President on Treatment of Returned Negro Military Personnel, September 20th through 21st, 1944. African-American servicemen, many of whom had fought next to white soldiers in combat, expected to be treated with dignity and respect when they returned to the United States. But the military's segregationist policies extended to the return and redistribution centers set up to help veterans transition to civilian life. In this memo to FDR, Secretary of War Henry Stimson makes the case for separate but equal facilities for returning black servicemen. Because Stimson's memo came in the midst of the 1944 election campaign, presidential adviser Jonathan Daniels wrote a counter memo to make sure that FDR was aware of the politically sensitive nature of the issue. Document 6.6, Petition to bury Jim Crowism, October 1944. Throughout the war, African American leaders continued to press for an end to discrimination at home and in the armed forces. They believed that discrimination in the military and at home, including the Jim Crow laws of the South, were inconsistent with the ideals for which the United Nations were fighting. During the 1944 presidential campaign, A. Philip Randolph and his March on Washington movement circulated petitions like this one, urging the president to use his powers as commander-in-chief to ban discrimination and segregation in the government and military, abolish the poll tax, and protect the right to vote. FDR and African Americans, book excerpts. Lauren Rebecca Sklaroff, Black Culture and the New Deal, The Quest for Civil Rights in the Roosevelt Era, University of North Carolina Press, 2009, pages 1 and 2. A powerful Southern congressional bloc influenced the executive treatment of race relations during the Depression and World War II. 4 years after Franklin Roosevelt's death, Eleanor Roosevelt remembered her frustrations when racial issues, such as the anti-lynching bill and the abolition of the poll tax, reached her husband's desk. Although Franklin was in favor of both measures, they never became must legislation. When I would protest, he would simply say, "First things come first, and I can't alienate certain votes I need for measures that are more important at the moment by pushing any measure that would entail a fight." A powerful Southern congressional bloc influenced the executive treatment of race relations during the Depression and World War II. To the chagrin of many civil rights leaders, the support of this Southern contingency always outweighed the administration's commitment to endorsing measures that would explicitly improve political, economic, and social conditions of black Americans. Still, the federal government did not completely ignore civil rights in this politically explosive atmosphere. One important method that the Roosevelt administration employed to acknowledge African Americans and to involve them in the president's New Deal was through federally sponsored cultural programs. Initially conceived under the Works Progress Administration's Federal Arts Project, and then continued under wartime agencies such as the Office of War Information and the War Department, fine art and media-based programs represented an important strand of civil rights policy during the Roosevelt era. Through these programs, liberal administrators demonstrated a sustained commitment to addressing the concerns of black Americans when political pragmatism prevented official support for structural legislation. Joyce A. Hansen, Mary McLeod Bethune, and Black Women's Political Activism, University of Missouri Press, 2003, pages 125 to 126 and 131. FDR appointed more black leaders to important posts than ever. By the 1930s, African Americans were in dire need of a New Deal, and many black leaders eagerly looked to the Roosevelt administration for the support they needed to achieve economic, political, and social equality. Roosevelt inspired many blacks when he appointed a number of men as agency heads who openly and aggressively committed themselves to the cause of social justice and civil rights for black Americans. African Americans expected the Roosevelt administration to support their continuing struggle for increased employment opportunities, economic security, and the protection of civil rights. However, the implementation and effects of many early New Deal programs did not always reassure them. Discriminatory implementation of many programs at the local level circumscribed material progress, but the psychological benefits that accrued to the black community as a whole were extensive. For the first time, they saw the federal government hiring African Americans for a number of important positions. The Roosevelt administration hired black professionals as architects, lawyers, statisticians, economists, and engineers within the federal government. Non-professionals filled positions as stenographers, secretaries, messengers, elevator operators, and clerks. FDR appointed more black leaders to important posts than ever. Mary Poole, The Segregated Origins of Social Security, African Americans, and the Welfare State. University of North Carolina Press, 2006, pages 174 through 176. African Americans were discriminated against not because they were targeted by racist intent, but because Social Security rewarded those who were already privileged. How did African Americans become discriminated against through the Social Security Act? African Americans were discriminated against not because they were targeted by racist intent, but because Social Security rewarded those who were already privileged. It gave priority to the dignity and economic security of the working class's top tier, those who were most secure in jobs from which African Americans were barred. The study of discriminatory treatment of African Americans through public policy in the 1930s has been framed as a fight primarily waged between groups of white people, one group with altruistic motives, defending the rights of African Americans, the other group, self-interested, seeking to limit those rights. But this model does not fit the story of the Social Security Act. The act was designed by reformers whose intent was primarily altruistic. They did not set out to enhance their own power and wealth. Nevertheless, they benefited from the policy that they created as white men and women. The salvation of white industrial workers was predicated on constructing them as something other than welfare recipients and other than black workers. By enhancing the value of whiteness of industrial workers, the Act's framers enhanced the value of their own whiteness. The discriminatory policy created through the Social Security Act resulted more from the positioning of the Act's framers within the U.S. racial hierarchy than their intent. Kevin J. McMahon, Reconsidering Roosevelt on Race, How the Presidency Paved the Road to Brown. University of Chicago Press, 2004, pages 175 to 176. Franklin Roosevelt displayed what might be described as fits of courage in dealing with the challenge to the Southern way of life and the corresponding drive to secure civil rights. The activities of the Roosevelt Justice Department did much to shape judicial doctrine in the post-war era. With its call for activism to federally secure and protect the rights of African Americans, the department helped the Roosevelt Court to lay the precedential cornerstone of its new civil rights doctrine. To be sure, FDR was neither a consistent nor a vocal proponent of civil rights reform. His pro-civil rights decisions were often buffered by others in which he balked at progressive efforts in order to ease tensions within the Democratic Party. In sum, he displayed what might be described as fits of courage in dealing with the challenge to the Southern way of life and the corresponding drive to secure civil rights. When civil rights proposals appeared to also advance his broader institutional goals of a national government dominated by a progressive presidency or electoral goals of a more liberal coalition, he often supported them energetically. When they did not, he took few public chances, preferring instead to work subtly, which usually meant slowly, behind the scenes, or not at all. Nevertheless, the full story of FDR's successes in civil rights is more elaborate than the one typically told. Despite the presence of the Dixiecrat-dominated leadership in Congress and the South's significance in the New Deal electoral coalition, the Roosevelt administration was able to help forge the Supreme Court's mission after 1937. In turn, the Roosevelt justices sought to carry out what the president had failed to achieve in the 1938 elections. Southern Democrats survived FDR's purge, but Southern democracy would not escape the rulings of the Roosevelt-Warren Court. David M. Kennedy, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 through 1945. Oxford University Press, 1999, pages 765 to 768. Now, for the first time since Reconstruction, the federal government had openly committed itself to making good on at least some of the promises of American life for black citizens. The continued isolation of black Americans was made achingly obvious as war mobilization began to lift the pall of the Depression. Management and labor joined arms to exclude black workers from the benefits of the war boom. A threatened march on Washington by 100,000 African Americans led to FDR's Executive Order 8802, issued on June 25, 1941. There shall be no discrimination in the employment of workers in defense industries or government because of race, creed, color, or national origin, it declared, adding that both employers and labor unions had a positive duty to provide for the full and equitable participation of all workers in defense industries. A newly established Fair Employment Practices Commission was empowered to investigate complaints and take remedial action. It would be too much to say that Executive Order 8802 was a second Emancipation Proclamation. Yet, however grudgingly, Franklin Roosevelt had set the nation back on the freedom road that Abraham Lincoln had opened in the midst of another war three quarters of a century earlier. For seven decades, it had remained the road not taken. Now, for the first time since Reconstruction, the federal government had openly committed itself to making good on at least some of the promises of American life for black citizens. Coming at a moment that was kindled with opportunities for economic betterment and social mobility, Executive Order 8802 fanned the rising flame of black militancy and initiated a chain of events that would eventually end segregation once and for all and open a new era for African Americans. Neil A. Wynn, The African American Experience During World War II, Roman and Littlefield, 2010, pages 97 to 98. The African American experience in World War II clearly had enormous significance in shaping developments in the coming decades. Neither a beginning nor an end in civil rights history, the war took further issues raised in the 1930s and beyond and paved the way for future developments. The war years brought massive economic, demographic, and ideological shifts in the makeup of the American population. The removal of millions of men and women into the armed forces and their service overseas in itself generated considerable upheaval. The war boom accelerated the movement of populations into the defense industries, precipitating huge growth in urban centers, new and old, and intensifying problems in the workplace, housing, and public recreation. For African Americans, all these things carried an additional dimension. Military service raised questions that had been posed throughout American history concerning segregation, limits to service, and their significance in relation to black claims for citizenship and equal rights. Black service personnel returning from Alaska and the Aleutians, from Europe and Asia, arrived back on American soil, expectant and determined to see change, as were the men and women who had contributed to the war effort at home. If the war did not bring total, overwhelming, and complete change, it brought enough to establish the preconditions for another generation to demand that the United States indeed practice the very principles it espoused at home and continued to defend abroad. The achievement of so much in terms of presidential action and changing federal policy during and immediately after the war seemed to indicate a new commitment to racial equality. You'll now be automatically redirected back to wherever you left off in the base message.